Okay, so we're on Yud Dalad Amud Aleph. Excuse me, and as Phil said, we had got through the four cases of Rav Yosef, but I just wanted to go back to the beginning, to before them. Sorry, they've. let's start from, I think, as I said, six lines down. So the second last word on the line is Inni, which is a little bit in the middle of. Inni is a question, so it's a little bit in the middle, but it sort of does set up excuse me, a new section. So basically, the Gemara's question is that basically we're talking about the obligation of shein and regel payments in excuse me, chotzer shutfim, so a joint location. Okay, so you have a property or something which is considered to be both the Reshut HaNizak and the Reshut HaMazik, belongs to both, or it's rented by both, or basically they have both permission to be there, and it could be a joint hotel room even, right? It's, the point is, it doesn't mean you have to own it, just means that it's your place, your space. And we had originally said that there's no liability there. Okay, no liability, you would be potter in that case. So, Inni, the Gemara wants to know, is that really true? Vahatani Rav Yosef. Everyone with me? Vahatani Rav Yosef. Didn't Rav Yosef teach as follows? Chotzer hashutfim vehapundak chayev. Right? He says that it's you're liable in that sort of place. You're obligated to pay. Chayev bohen al hashein v'al haregel. To you, after the Rabbi Lazar. So Gemara says, yeah, that's a good... that's a good rejoinder, right? It's a good response. You don't, excuse me, that's a disproof for Rabbi Lazar, and therefore we're going to leave him aside. But he comes back. Omer lecha Rabbi Lazar, what do you mean? That's not fair. V'tisbara, does that really work? Masnisa mi lo pligi. Isn't there someone who disagrees with this Mishnah, right? You've shown me a statement of Rav Yosef, but I have something which backs me up as well. V'hatanya, I have the following brisa. Arba'a klolos haya Rav Shimon ben Elazar Omer. So he says there are four sort of types of cases, okay? And it might help to number them, because we're going to refer back to these quite a bit. But these are the four sort of possibilities, effectively. Okay, these are the four possibilities. So number one, sorry, benezikin, okay, in damages. Kol she reshus lenizak velo lemazik. Okay, so if we're talking about somewhere which is the property of the nizak, of the damaged party, but not of the damager, then chayev. Chayev bakol. Okay, very strong loshen. Very strong language. Bakol means, sounds like in everything, right? Potentially even more than let's say, in public place. Okay, we'll have to discuss that as to whether that you might even be more liable than you would be in, you know, in the middle of a road. We're talking about now you're on the damaged person's property. Or the animal, the damage occurred on the damaged person's property. Chayev bakol. That's number one. Number two is demazik, of a place which belongs to the mazik of the damaging party. Then velola nizak, right? Only his property. Potter mikol. Again, you're exempt from everything. Sounds very, again, very strong. Sort of the opposite extreme. Lazer velazer, kugon chotzer hashutfim vehabika. If it's owned by both, it's considered to be the place of both. Excuse me, then. Chotzer Ashutvim, a joint property or a bika or a a valley. Potter ba ala shein va ala regel. Then you're exempt from shein and regel, which again is different to what we said before. You're exempt from shein and regel. Al hanagicha va al hanagifa va al hanashicha va al haravitza va al habaita. All these different types of keren. Biting, pushing, kicking, goring, right, all that sort of stuff, stamping. then, tam mishalem chatzi nezek, muad mishalem nezek shalem. Then you are liable for, in the normal rules of Keren, basically. You fall back on the normal rules of Keren. So although you're exempt from Shein and Regel, you're going to be liable for Keren. Excuse me. But... Lo lozev, lo lozev. If it belongs to neither, then kugon chotzer she'ina shal shneim. If it's a private property of somebody else, where the damage occurs, then chayev ba'al hashen ba'al regel ba'al hanegicha ba'al hanshicha ba'al hanegicha. So you would be liable as usual for shein and regel, and you would be liable for keren again as usual on all those sorts of cases. Tam mishalim chatzin nezek muad mishalim nezek shalim. Okay, so you're going to be required to pay back, as I said, keren as usual and shein and regel as usual. Shein and regel as usual. Okay, fine. So now,
but in the first case, are you still not liable?
You are. The first case, you're most liable. What do you mean, the first case?
For eating and trampling, where is joint? Where's joint owned?
That's the debate. We seem to have two opinions over here. Where is joint owned? Whether you're liable for
one is joint, one was not joint. The first one is where joint owned. The second one is
when you're talking about what's the first one? You mean
the first one where it says where court yerah is designated for use of both parties. It says property is.
Hashutvim v'hapundak, or the inn.
Yeah.
That's the opinion of Rav Yosef, and then we have the opinion over here of Rav Shimon ben Elazar, which is that you're exempt from Shein and Regel. So we seem to have a difference of opinion. We have one Mishnah.
Is it simply a question of who's entitled to use that particular property?
So we can, you can potentially look at it different. Let's come back to the reasoning in just a moment. Okay, let's just finish off this this flow of the Gemara, and then we'll try and insert some reasoning in there. Okay. Katani Mihas. So the this is now the last thin line in the Gemara. Katani Mihas. Okay, the bottom line is that through all of that long statement, right, the third case was at the very least Chotzer Ashutfim Va'Bika Potter. Right, so Rabbi Loza is saying, I have something to back me up. We have a statement which says that a joint property is exempt. as Andy pointed out, right, we have over here saying it's exempt. Earlier we said it's liable. Ba'al Hashein Va'al HaRegel. So Kasha Ahadadi. Right? Kasha Ahadadi. They seem to contradict each other, or they seem to be clashing with each other. Excuse me. So the Gemara responds and says, Kitanya Hahi. Right? When was it talking about, which one is talking about what? Basically, they might be referring to different things, the Gemara is going to suggest. That maybe the one that says you're obligated is talking about a specific circumstance, and the one that says you're exempt is talking about a specific circumstance. Kitanya hahi bechotzer miyuchedes. Which one's hahi? The first hahi is talking about Rav Shimon ben Elazar, the exempt case. Okay, so why would you be exempt in this joint property? Kitanya hahi bechotzer miyuchedes laze velaze bein leperos bein leshvarim. Okay, it's talking about but basically it's a joint place that makes sense for you to put your food, and for you to take your animals as well. For instance, like a bikkah, right? Like this valley, as was mentioned. I think it's a bikkah, or was that the one that said pundak?
Bikkah was in this more recent.
Yeah, so that's the one but where you're exempt, right?
How do you know that hahi means that one, the second one?
Oh, because I have a cheap... Oh, well, Rashi says it as well. Yeah.
Who would be that one, the further one?
No, but I think, sorry, but what I was going to say is that I think it makes sense, because a bikkah does sound like a place which, a bikkah is a valley, right? So it sounds like a very open place. It makes it sound like, yes, if you and I own a valley together, then that makes sense that you and I are going to bring in not just our payros, right? Not just our produce and our food and our utensils, but also our animals as well. They're going to be wandering around the valley, right? But what about... Right, but Hahida of Yosef, that's the ironclad, comparing it to Hahida of Yosef, which is clearly the earlier one, right? The one that's referring to Rav Yosef, and that says you are liable. V'chotzen miyuchedes leperos ve'ena miyuchedes leshevarim. It's a place where you would be expected to bring food, but you wouldn't be expected to bring your animals. De legabe shein, havi lo chotzer hanizak. It specifically is... The excuse me, with regards to Shane, it basically is considered to be the property of the Nizak, of the damaged party, because the damaging party shouldn't have had their animal in there. It wasn't a place that was designated for animals. How do you know that? How do you know that? The Gemara says, Daikanami, this makes sense. Dikatani Hocha, it says Dumyulapundak, right? It says one was talking about a bikkah valley, which we said before, right? It's an open space, makes sense for animals. One was talking about a pundak. A pundak, I think, is like an inn, right? So if you're talking about, let's say, a hotel lobby, right? Hotel lobby, You and I may have permission to be in there and to have our food in there and to have our utensils in there and all of that sort of stuff. We don't. No one expects you to bring your ox into the middle of the hotel lobby, right in the middle of the inn. So therefore, yes, it's a joint place to Rosh Hashanah Nizak v'Hamazik, but not with regards to having your animal in there, and therefore you're going to be liable in that case. That's what the one Rav Yosef is talking about, where you're going to be liable. Right, but the other one we're talking about where you're going to be exempt. Let's just finish it off with Katani Hasam Dumi Debika Shma Mina. Yes, sorry. Questions, and we can think about what the.
Is it actually saying that the valley is a big space joint ownership? The other one, why can't it be a valley as well? Because they talk about courtyards and both. So why can't it be a joint large courtyard or a joint large or singly owned valley, for example? See, my point is, if where it's jointly owned and it's expected that there are going to be cattle there from both parties, if you can identify the party's cattle which is causing the damage,
right,
why should they be exempt again?
Because it's not, because again, that's part of, it's almost like part of the expectation. You bring your animals in and you leave your food lying around and the animal eats your food.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, on both these cases, I don't see the distinction between whether one's a valley jointly owned and one's a valley singly owned.
No, they're both jointly owned.
It's the purpose for which your joint endeavour is established.
Is that what it's saying?
Yeah, one is expected for you to have in there for both parties. I don't think it's just about jointly owned, by the way. Sorry, when we're talking about a valley, it means that you both have
use.
Yeah, correct. You both. It's normal for you. It's expected that you would both be in there, as compared to lo lo zeh v'lo lo zeh, could go in chotzer she'ena shel shneihem, which means someone else's garden. There's no reason for either of you to be in someone else's field or someone else's garden. That's what it's talking about. So this is talking about, so far as I've understood it, can be a public space or can be a place where you've both rented it together or own it together. But the point is, both of you can legitimately expect to be there. Both of you can legitimately expect to leave your food in there. And in one case, you can legitimately expect to leave your animals wandering around in there. In the other case, you can't. So in a case where your animals are legitimately expected to be wandering around in there, then I assume the exemption is because, in a sense, you know, the person if you leave food lying around there, right, then it's gonna get eaten up. So I'm not gonna pay you back for your hamburger that you left while my dogs were running around, because it's part of our normal, you know. Yeah, correct. That's the setup over here. Whereas if it's a place where animals are not expected to be, like you said, like an inn, then you're going to be exempt in that case. So we've gone actually from, it's funny, it's full circle really, because initially we almost disagreed with Rabbi Elazar. We had a proof against Rabbi Elazar. We brought this Mishnah which said that you're exempt, which disagreed with. Sorry, we had brought this Mishnah which said you're liable, which disagreed with Rabbi Elazar. Then Rabbi Elazar said, "What do you mean? I have a brisa which is for me," and it made it sound like there was a debate, right? But now the Gemara sort of concluded and said they're not even debating, right? It's almost everybody agrees that it depends on the circumstances, right? In some circumstances you're going to be liable, in others you're going to be. Going to be exempt. I mean, we're not quite finished yet. Let's get down to the two dots, just a few more lines, and then we'll try and also insert a little bit more, in a thought and logic into this as well, to try and sort of understand it a little bit more. Maskif lo rabzeira. So rabzeira asks the following question: Kiven de miyuchedes leperos. Since it is set aside for food, right? You're expecting to be using this for your food. Then haba inon ubier bisde acher veleka. So he's saying this is now questioning the person who says that you're liable, right? Questioning the valley where we said that you're liable. Sorry, excuse me. Questioning the questioning the one where you're liable, right? So questioning the one, the inn, right? Since it's since it's expected the fruit is going to be there, then haba inon uvier b'sde acher v'leka. Here Rashi says, this is Rashi more or less at the same, a couple of lines below that. So Rashi's the first word on the line is bo'inon sde acher. So he obviously has a slightly different language, but I think he's definitely referring to that same place. So he says, "Bo'inan sedei acher v'leka shaharayesh lemazik rishus ba lahachnis peirosov." Right? Basically, it doesn't fit with the language of the Torah, because the Torah specifically makes you liable for Shane in a case where you're doing it almost in somewhere else, in another person's field, somewhere where you shouldn't be. But the fact is that since you have this permission to have your payros in there, to have your own food in there, then it's not quite other enough. It's not quite a sedei acher. It's not quite someone else's field. It's a normal place for you to be. And and therefore, maybe you should still be exempt. You should still be exempt. So Amar Le Abaye, Abaye responds, Kiven de'eina miyuchedes l'shevarim, since it's not set aside for animals, right? It's not considered yours for animals, then sedei acher karina bay. That's called sedei acher. That is considered another field, somewhere else, because your animal shouldn't be there. With regards to your animal, which caused the damage, it should be, it is called another field. It's called somewhere else. Amar Le Rav Acha midifti l'ravina, Rav Acha midifti asks Ravina as follows, Lema midamas nisa lo pligi amaroi nami lo pligi. So maybe now that we've resolved the contradiction on the resolved the argument on the Tanaitic level, maybe we should do it on the Amoraic level as well, right? So we've said we initially started with the machlokes amaroim, then we brought proofs from Tanoim, from a Mishnah and a Brisa. Now that we've resolved the Mishnah and the Brisa and said actually they fit well together, right? It's just circumstantial, right? Whether you're going to be liable or not. So maybe we should say the same thing about the Amoraim, that there's no real debate between the Amoraim. There's actually, they would all agree in principle. So Namila Pligi. So Amalein, yeah, maybe that's good. Yeah, that could work. Vim Tim Talomar, we're not so convinced, right? You could still suggest that they are arguing. Pligi, Bekusha de Rabzera over Peruka de Abaye Pligi. So here I think he's saying that they are arguing they're arguing about this Rabzera and Abaye that we've just had, right? The debate centers around this point that we've just talked about, whether it is considered to be Sedei Acher or not. Okay, so let's just I think we did that inside. Now let's just try and consider that outside. Okay, so we had this, as we said, we had these two differing statements within the Mishnah and the Brisa. One said you're liable, and one said you're exempt. We're talking about Shane and Regel in let's call it a public place for now. Okay, Shane and Regel in public place. So we resolved that by saying that one is referring to a public place where it's normal for animals to be, and one is referring to a public place where animals not normal to be. I said, okay, great. So everybody agrees. So I said, no, not so straightforward that everybody agrees, because you can actually argue that some might say that you would still be liable in a place where it's you could still be exempt in a place where it's not normal for animals to be, because the Torah refers to it as Sdei Acher, right? Refers to it as a foreign place, almost like another field somewhere else. And the fact that you can be there, you have rights to be in that place, even though you can't bring your animals there, the fact that you have some rights in that place, right, makes it almost it's too high a price. It's the bar is set low enough by the Torah that that's considered to be not somewhere else, not a foreign place, and therefore the fact that your animals came where you are, you can be there. Therefore, your animals, an extension of you, can be there. So therefore, you're going to be exempt, and that's basically how we've left it. That we're not really sure whether there is this differing opinion or not. And you could view this as everyone agreeing, or you could say no. The debate centers around whether the damage that's done here is considered to be done in Sedei Acher, or whether it's considered to be done in your specific property. And we'll so there's a few different ways that you can view that, if I remember correctly. I think basically a lot of people have what to say on this. Let's see if I can find a quick a quick few mentions. But for instance, In general, I think we've talked about this right way back at the beginning when we talked, when we started the first Mishnah, talked about the fact that, that throughout Bava Kamma you can sort of look or find places where we where we're sort of more focused on the damage that's done or the cause of the damage, right? As to whether when we're talking about damages, damage payments being required, is the impetus for that, is that sort of starting from a place of, well, someone should be, you know, this needs to be sorted because damage was done, or is it, no, you have done something wrong, and therefore you're going to be liable for this. So I think you can see that over here, right? You can see that in a sense, whether the focus is on the damage that was done, i.e. the peiros in this case, right? The food that was eaten. So the food that was eaten, was that in Sdei Acher? No, that wasn't in Sdei Acher because we both had rights to keep our food in there. Right, so you could potentially say that this is, you know, this in a sense, this is not considered to be Sdei Acher with regards to peiros, and therefore not to animals either. Or you could say, no, the focus here is more on the damaging party, right? I.e. on the shor, in this case, the animal. The animal is definitely not considered to be, is definitely considered to be in a Sdei Acher. You had no right, you had no rights to have your animals in there, and therefore, again, you're going to be... Excuse me. You're going to be liable. You're going to be liable in that case. And you have an interesting discussion. Yeah, as follows. So okay. So let's say. So the Chazanish, I think, has the following question. Okay, what if you have a place where you and I both have a joint agreement? Okay, my agreement is that I can bring my food in there, and your agreement is you can bring your animals in there. So what's that, and then your animal eats my food. So what's that considered? Is that considered Sdei Acher with regards to animal, right? Is that, so now you sort of, you're a little bit in between the two cases. Is it considered lo lozer ve lo lozer, right? It's basically sort of neither of ours. Or we're going to say, so I think that it's going to depend on how you fall on this, on which side, in a sense, as to whether the focus is more on the damaged party, or the focus is a little bit more on the damaging party, right? In terms of the liability, in terms of the what's the word, the birth almost of the liability, the sort of the creation of this obligation. Okay. Let's see if we find any other. There was another few good.
Things
which you saw. Chazanish, let's see. Okay, so I can read it in Latin. Yeah, go on.
My guess would be that if I've consented to have animals roaming around where and to share occupation of my food, actually, it must have been in their contemplation that the food would be eaten by those animals potentially, and therefore, if the food is eaten, he's got no claim.
I'm going to read the Chazanish inside in just a minute, but just before I do, let's just say you could say the opposite. You could say that I've consented to put my animals in a place where I know there's food there. Clearly, the expectation is that I'm going to. Right, I know the arrangement that we made is that you're going to put your food in there. So when I put my animals in there, I know that I'm going to have to do it in a way which is going to sort of stop them from eating it. Anyway, okay. So the Chazanish said, yeah. He said, "Na'amid es abra." This is not the exact language. This is a paraphrasing of the Chazanish. Shechotzer amicheles lo lozer lozer leperos uleshvorim ele leperos bilvat. So it's considered to be. Yeah. So what one as I said has access with their food, and one said the one is oh sorry one is food and animals. Oh no, it's not. Sorry. It's not, sorry. It is just one of each. Okay, so one can bring in the animals, one can bring in their food. So that's what it's referring to. The Tirit Sheba Ofen Zeh Lo Yimtza Din. Oh, sorry, excuse me. I misunderstood the Chazanish. The Chazanish's question is basically, why doesn't the Braisa say that? That in a sense, Lo Zeh Ve Lo Zeh, is that's what it's referring to. So he says in that particular case, that it wouldn't be considered Rosh Hashanah bin Negicha. Forgive me. I misread that Chazanish. So he wasn't really asking that question at all. So he doesn't give an answer to that. So I don't know. He was asking a linguistic question. Why doesn't the Brisa talk about why instead of sort of making it belong to neither, just say for one it was for food and for one it was for animals? And he says basically in that particular case, then when you have the Keren issue, then that doesn't add up. Although actually, from to be honest, what you see from there is that my understanding is that in that case he would say Shane, you would be liable, right? Because that's his point. His point is why didn't we say that lo lo zeh lo lo zeh case, the last one where you're liable for everything basically as normal, should be you should be. So, and his answer is that it doesn't work for the Keren side. So, implying that it would work for the Shane side, which is exactly what Phil said, that you would be liable in that case for.
The common sense would be that you would actually designate a place for the food and designate a place for the animals.
Presumably, that was. Yeah.
That would be the common.
No, everyone. Common sense is always beforehand, and the point is afterwards. After this has happened, that is the common sense thing to do. But who should have ensured that would happen? The owner of the animals, or should it be the owner whose responsibility was it to ensure that the common sense thing happened?
Rabbi, we're looking at here is the reason why we're finding that actually there are conflicting brises, or seemingly conflicting brises, is that in the oral tradition, what was brought down was missing a part of the analysis. In other words, that there was it was remembered that such and such a Rav had such and such a view, but we didn't have the complete explanation as to his analysis for that particular view.
It's a massive, massive question, which is it's a very general question, meaning like nothing correct. So there's a great book called The Dynamics of Dispute. The answer to that, as you would expect, is that in and of itself is a subject of debate as to whether when we talk about machlokes, is that basically as a result of things getting confused in the tradition, correct? Or is it a result? Or was that always the intention, in a sense that you're showing different perspectives, right? That you're showing, in a sense, different perspectives, and that's normal. So I don't want to. That's I think that's a much more philosophical, philosophical thing.
Was that the same and problem in Yerushalmi, where they
problem everywhere.
What's
my feeling on this? Feeling is somewhere in the middle of it, in the sense that I think it's hard. The oral tradition is a very it's one of those things that when you first hear about it sounds really silly, but the more I look at it, and the more I study it, and the more I look at other systems, I find it to be the best possible. I find it to be very, very impressive, actually. And the way that things get least confused and least lost, actually, because, like, for instance, so I tell you, the first time I ever asked this question was as follows. So I, although I can remember, this is really going off piece, but while we've raised it, it's an interesting topic. When it was my brother's bar mitzvah, I was in yeshiva, and my brother came to visit me just before his bar mitzvah, and we were talking a little bit about tefillin. And tefillin is one of those areas where there's loads of halacha l'moshe m'Sinai, and so we got talking about this sort of stuff. You know, why is there so much? There's a lot that's written, and then there's loads that's not written. You know, in Torah just says wear tefillin, right? And then we have traditions that say it's black, and traditions that say it's square, and traditions that say it doesn't go between your eyes. It goes, you know, sort of apparently, effectively between your eyes, but higher up, and all this sort of stuff. They're not written anywhere. No Torah, no doesn't clarify that anyway. So why is that? So we went to ask Rav Nementhal, who was the Rav of the Old City, who was sitting there, and he gave. I think there are lots of answers, but the answer he gave me, which really got me thinking at the time, was he said, no matter how much you write things down, he said you can never clarify it to the fullest extent. Even when you write it down and you write down your explanations, there's still going to be room for debate. And the more I've studied, the more I've realized how true that is. That in a sense you can have. You guys get much more involved in this than I do, but you can have like pages and pages and pages of of contracts, you know, that are trying to close every possible loophole and sort of clarify every possible instance, etc., and all this sort of stuff. And you'll still find that at the end of the day, one person can present it this way, and the other one can present it that way, and you can still find one word here and one word there that's going to end up being a subject of debate. And in a sense, what the oral tradition is saying is we're going to do away with that whole thing. And that is, it's almost very concise at the beginning. And yes, as the generations have gone on, we've had to explain more, and we've had to write down more and more of the explanations. But the real goal is this. The real goal is that actually, when you sit down, it's almost like forcing you to sit down with someone and with people and say that we have to engage in this in order to understand it properly and in order to really do it. So the Mishnah and the Mishnah and the Braisa, to come back to your actual question, were never really, so far as I can understand, were never really, there was no day where they sat down and they said, we're all going to write down the Mishnah, we're all going to write down the Braisa. What happened was that these were discussions, these were statements, they were all studied together, and then it was sort of compiled together. And obviously, again, not entirely, as with all history, you know, there are different opinions as to how exactly it came about, but broadly speaking, they're taking these statements and they're compiling them together, and so the Gemara is almost like the Gemara is the next level down. The Gemara is basically the discussions of those Mishnaic statements, right? It was all these Bate Medrash, right? There was Pumbadisa, and there was Nahara, and there was all these places where they would discuss them, and they would sort of go through all the cases and try and understand them and figure them out. And then the Gemara eventually sort of became these discussions, right? Became these teachings and these lessons. So whether it was to do with forgetting, coming back to the original question, whether it was to do with forgetting or to do with the different perspectives, I don't want to make this as my opinion, because I think you have to have quite a serious breadth to have a proper opinion on this, but I find it at different times I find it both hard to imagine that there is no breakdown, that there is no sort of confusion that happens over the generations, and at the same time, from a more philosophical perspective, I find it impossible that sort of, you know, God would create a system where we would lose it, in a sense. That in a sense, part of our belief in the Torah is the fact that this corpus has retained its authenticity throughout the generations, and losing, I think this is, I have a feeling this is the opinion of the Rambam, but there is, whoever it is, somebody does clarify that it's almost like to suggest that machlokas comes about because people have forgotten things is almost to sort of undermine the entire corpus, you know, to undermine the entire thing, because it makes it sound, okay, great, so you, in a sense, the Mishnah has these opinions, but it doesn't matter whether they have those opinions, because the whole thing was forgotten anyway, and they just made it up again, you know, so you just sort of you can choose a different one. Choose whichever one you want. So I guess I sort of fall somewhere in the middle of them, without having answered the question. But it's a very interesting longer discussion. What do you guys think? What do you think?
Well, there's another alternative, which is that what you've got is deliberate, not ambiguity, but sort of, if you explain something in principle sparsely, then you're almost forced in each generation or in each iteration when you sit down to rethink it.
I think that's
and
the...
actually, as you rethink it, you bring a contemporary understanding to the principles, and perforce those change. But maybe that ability to have that flexibility of approach is part of the architecture of the part of the start. I think it's what you were.
I think that is the second approach.
I think that's, yeah, I think it's what you were saying, but also what it means is that it allows, in a way, it's a more, it's So in that flexible. Sense, there's the flexibility to bring, yeah, it's the flexibility to bring one's contemporary understanding to fundamental precepts.
But I think, I think everybody subscribes to that to some extent. I mean, I think Rav Hirsch talks about that.
But there are other places where actually Gemara itself is unable to reconcile these.
Right.
It's a difficult discussion, but it leaves it there because
that's like life. There's theoretical and there's actual, right? And in a sense, you don't have to resolve a theoretical debate. You only have to resolve an actual in practice, right? And let's say when you have a Gemara that says teku, there are principles that help us move forward if we're talking about a real case. But almost what the Gemara is saying is that, yes, theoretically both can be, or there's sort of elements of truth in both. You know, like you don't have to. Trying to think of like a good in terms to move forward in life. Sometimes you have to have the answer, but at other times you don't have to have the answer. You know, you can see both sides, right? You can say both are true, right? And in a sense, we're recognizing that. So I think
my problem with this is if we're going to have rationale for all the statements, the Gemara would fill this room, right? The volumes are just too enormous. Having said that, you know, in English law cases where a decision is argued and the reasoning given, it doesn't mean to say you can't then reopen that and distinguish it and differentiate it in other debates.
Yeah.
But at least you understand the reasoning. One of my major frustrations with learning tomorrow is often the questions seem totally bizarre and weak and irrelevant because it's not clear the basis on which they're arguing.
But that's
what I find particularly frustrating.
That's so interesting. But I think that's because we're skipping a lot. Maybe we're moving too fast. Maybe that's what it is.
I've always found that in the last 20 odd years of studying it, I haven't changed that.
But in a sense, that's the Gemara. You talk about the fact that if you were to write this all down, the Gemara would fill the room.
Yeah.
That's what does fill the room in a sense. The Gemara was not the end point, right? The reason why we learn Gemara, maybe this is a good place to actually, this is totally separate. The reason why we learn the Gemara is almost to open the conversations, not to end the conversations. So the Gemara is the beginning. The explanations are found in, are written down. Again, at the time, they were all, you know, explained orally, right? But they were written down slowly over time, more and more, by Rishonim, by Achronim, by all these sorts of things. You know, you can open up, and that's why, say, you know, you go into a Beis Medrash, and it's filled with you know, Rashi and the Rambam and the Rashba and the Ritva and, you know, millions of Rishonim, and then you get to the Achronim, you know, and you have Rabbi Akiva Eiger and the Vilna Gaon and whoever, and Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rabbi Elchanan Rassam, and, you know, it was literally, you know, as you say, endless books and then you know, more and more writings and explanations. And I think that's exactly that. And
often we don't need half the discussions to take place because they are simply testing something to destruction. It doesn't need testing to destruction. That's something that on the face of it is obvious. And if it's not obvious, then you should be explaining why you say it's not obvious.
I think what it's doing is it's setting limitations. That's the way I view it sometimes. So it's almost like there are limits to the debate, right? So for instance, you can when we open debates, Phil was talking about very astutely, talking about the fact that, you know, we sort of bring our contemporary analysis to stuff and we look at things. We're not opening up. I guess also there's a difference between this forum, with great respect to everyone here, I include myself in this. There's a difference between this forum, and we're talking about these things, and a forum where we're talking about people who have a great understanding of everything that's come before. So, you know, when you present a case, let's say our case, right, we're talking about, you put an animal in this room and fruit in this room, and who owns the place, and what's the arrangement, and we can all theorize and come up with our ideas. But what the Gemara and Rishonim and Achronim, etc., and all of that does is it gives us sort of a framework with which to discuss it, right? It's not just logic on its own. It's like a trained logic, almost. It's like a logic that has been distilled over time, right? You can, when you come to, as a Rav Moshe Feinstein, okay, because I like reading Rav Moshe Feinstein's Shuvas, when you read his responsa about modern topics, questions which never happened before, and questions which he reopens, right? Questions which were discussed before, and he often takes on other Achronim, he takes on the Chasim Sofer or whoever, you know, who lived 200 years before him, and he says that he's doing that, yes, with, you know, with his own perspective, you know, and certainly, you know, with his own logic, you know, and that sort of stuff, but he's also doing that with a great amount of background knowledge, and not just background knowledge, but background training, right? Training in the sense of like a perspective, of a way to look at things, you know, which is done from knowing not just, you know, one Gemara here or one Gemara there, but really sort of living and breathing the entire corpus of Torah, Nevi'im, Sevi'im, Mishnah, Gemara, you know, all that sort of stuff. And that's what I think we try to get to. That's what I think we're trying to get to. And that's what, again, not that we should get too controversial in this or anything, but that's why I find sometimes there's a little bit of the frustration in some of the modern discussions, particularly when you read, you know, like blogs and all this sort of stuff, and people sort of writing... you know, this you can just pluck an opinion out of the air, say, you know, this concoct this this together with that, etc. Is yes, we, of course, we're bringing our own perspective to these things. Of course, we are. But you've also got to know, excuse me, you've also got to know how you're coming to that debate, right? Like, you can't just wake up one day and say, I don't know, this is my perspective and this is what I think. There's a Rav Schechter uses the phrase a lot. He uses the phrase a right to an opinion, right? He likes to use that phrase a lot. He talks about people having a right to an opinion. So it's almost like you've got to earn the right to have you have a right to an opinion all the time. I mean, I express my opinion all the time. But you also know when you have a right to a sort of like a more legitimate opinion that's people worth hearing about. And it's almost like you get to this point where in order to sort of be able to appreciate how to bring these ideas into practice, into fruition, takes a lot of the less glamorous side of just sort of just working through the basics, working through the simple thing. I use that as my own. I don't know if I should say this on the recording or not. I'll say it actually. I think it's very important. I use that for me. That's a bit of a litmus test. When I read about rabbis,
I completely agree with that. I know you don't have to mention any names, but there are some people who will only speak on topics.
Yes, which are controversial.
Sort of, which are,
yes,
sort of banner topics.
Yes,
and I think to myself, why don't you talk about some mundane
stuff as well? Right. So that's my litmus test. When I read halachic things about, and again, this is not no one specific in my mind at the moment, but again, when I read about, you know, topics on conversion, topics on divorce, topics on whatever, all sorts of things, you know, all the and more controversial topics as well. Whenever I want to see what that rabbi has written about the laws of you know, brachas on cashews or whatever, you know what I mean, or whatever the thing is, that's what I want to sort of get a sense of first, is like, what are the really, like you say, the boring mundane, like, where, yeah, correct, where is there to get there, to get a sense of their halachic, yeah, correct, to get a sense of their halachic approach generally, you know, and that's what, that's my that's a little bit of my litmus test. So it's a funny one, yeah, but anyway, but then, you know, we went really off topic, but I think it's very very interesting. Okay, so we've got to a decent place to stop, actually. So we've got to the two dots. We did have this debate, which we're not sure if it's a debate or not. And actually, sorry, I'll throw one more thing in there, and then we'll conclude with this, actually. I saw also a different explanation by... I think someone connected this to an earlier debate between the Rosh and the Rif, if I remember correctly, about about Regel. So when we talk about Regel, Regel, we said, is damages that's done, obviously, as the animal walks normally. And if it's in a Rosh Hashanah Rabbim, if it's in a public space, then they're going to be exempt, right? Whereas if you're in the Rosh Hashanah Nizak, if you're in the damaged party's field, then you're going to be liable. So what happens if you're walking along, the animal's walking along in the Rosh Hashanah, in the Rosh Hashanah Rabbim, in a public place, and there's a long stick, let's say, or a hose, you know, which extends across the public place, but is in the person's domain. And as the animal walks, it kicks that, which knocks over a pot or a vase in the person's rishus, right? So, what's considered? Which is the key place, right? Is it uvir b'sdei acher, right? Is it in their field, or is it done in public? So the machlokes between the Rosh and the Rif is basically how much we insert logic, or whether we go with the verse, right? Whether we say this is what we call a gezerat hakatuv, right? The gezerat hakatuv means literally, you know, the pasuk says this is that if it's in a Rosh Hashanah Rabbim, then you're exempt, and then you're liable, right? And if it's in Rosh Hashanah Rabbim, then you're exempt, and if it's in a Rosh Hashanah Nizak, then you're going to be liable. Or do we say, I think as the Rif says, so the Rosh says that. The Rosh says no. He said basically the damage occurred in someone else's property, and therefore that's you're going to be liable in that case. But he says, the Rif says, because it's normal, because it's Urchehu, so you're going to be exempt as a result, because it was still normal. So again, it comes back to, I guess, what we're talking about. It's not exactly the same, but it's similar in the sense that sometimes you also take this, I guess it's a little bit closer to what Americans call strict constructionist and loose constructionist, maybe a little bit. So the question is to what extent we insert the logic into these statements or not, particularly statements of the Torah. We don't have that with statements of the Gemara as much, but statements of the Torah. Okay, so we'll pick up next time with Gufa. Gufa, two-thirds of the way down. Okay.